Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Russian President Putin's op-ed in the New York Times, a plea for caution from Russia, and speak with Fiona Hill, a specialist on Russia at the Brookings Institution and co-author of the new book, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. We will discuss how Putin skillfully plays his weak hand while the United States clumsily plays its strong hand. Then we will speak with an expert on chemical weapons at the Stimson Center, Brian Finley, to find out, in the event that the U.S.-Russian deal to disarm Syrian chemical weapons goes through, how this vast arsenal can be corralled and destroyed in the midst of a civil war, when 16 years after signing onto the international ban, the U.S. still has not gotten rid of all of the world's second-largest chemical weapons arsenal. Then finally, we'll hear from the author of an article in The Atlantic, Stop Blaming Colonial Borders for the Middle East's Problems, to get an alternative view on the roots of the current turmoil in Syria. Nick Danforth, the editor of the cartography blog MidAfternoonMap.com, joins us to discuss how the pernicious policies of divide and rule that the British and French colonists used to sustain their power are more responsible for the post-Arab Spring chaos in the Middle East. And joining us now is Fiona Hill, who's the director of the Center on the United States and Europe and senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution. She's a frequent commentator on Russian and Eurasian affairs, who has researched and published extensively on issues related to Russia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, regional conflicts, energy, and strategic issues. She's also the co-author of the new book just out, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fiona Hill.
Oh, thanks, Ian.
And clearly, Vladimir Putin's op-ed in the New York Times is designed to appeal to an American audience. And I don't know the extent to which he's trying to drive a wedge between the American audience and the President of the United States. But he certainly succeeded in pushing a bunch of buttons. What's your analysis of it?
Well, Putin himself prides himself on this very act of communicating with people. He's always talking about this. It's one of the skills that he picked up in the KGB, working with and communicating with people. However, Putin likes to do these in very constrained formats and with very specific targeted audiences. He's not the kind of guy who really likes to wade into a crowd and then deal with whatever comes at him as it's happening. So what he's done here, clearly, is he's taken his cue very carefully. He even says it in the op-ed from the president's address to the nation. He's picked up on the president's words to throw right back at him. And he's clearly aiming over the head of the president, not to the American public at large. I mean, not everybody in the U.S. reads the New York Times, as we well know. It's a very elite, very specific audience that he's trying to engage with. It's people like you and I, and many of the listeners of KPFK. It's also many of the members of Congress. In fact, I mean, they all get briefings every day. I'm sure this was at the top of everybody's briefing in Congress and in the Senate as soon as it was out. It's the media. It's the chattering classes, as we often call them. It's people in think tanks. It's analysts. It's the educated population who are engaged all the time in foreign policy. And what he's trying to do is just to underscore the issues that he lays out there, that the U.S. cannot go it alone, that there's a United Nations international process. And he's also kind of appealing to some of the commentary he's already seen, or his people around him have already seen, opposing any kind of U.S. unilateral military strike in Syria.
So in a sense, it seems to me, Fiona Hill, that Vladimir Putin plays a very weak hand incredibly skillfully, and the United States, by contrast, plays a very strong hand rather clumsily. At least, you know, the back and forth in the last few days of accidental diplomacy where John Kerry, slip of the tongue, committed the president to a public address on Iraq, which the president hadn't mentioned, and then his rhetorical slip of the tongue at a press conference in London, where he basically said the only way the Syrians can avoid being bombed is giving up their chemical weapons, and of course they're not going to do that. And Putin seized on that. I mean, if you compare, for example, just looking at the UN figures on global GDP, the United States is number one, obviously, and Russia is at 10th place, U.S. with a $15 trillion GDP and Russia with a $1.8 trillion GDP. So if that's a measurement, I think it gives you an idea of the relative strength and weakness. Do you agree with my notion that Putin plays a weak hand skillfully while we play a strong hand rather clumsily?
Well, absolutely. And I mean, that's something that he also can always turn to his advantage, our own strengths, the strengths at least on the surface. But well, there's also weaknesses, as we all know, in those strengths. By being the only remaining world superpower, we have to be involved in almost every different instance. And or people expect us to be involved in every crisis, large or small. We're seen as the indispensable power. Putin can pick and choose, and he picks his battles very carefully. In the case of Syria, he actually has some really important interests at play here. And so he's going to do whatever it takes to outsmart the United States, to get us off balance, and to push our own strengths and our own words against us. He's looking for every opportunity to capitalize on something, a mistake, a misstep, and to turn that to his advantage. In the case of what you've just laid out there with John Kerry making a couple of gaffes that turned things in a very different direction from perhaps what the United States would have anticipated, Putin has been just waiting on the sidelines, watching for these kinds of things to happen. And he comes forward with this proposal on Syria that is not especially original. Ever since he made the proposal, or he pushed it out there and Kerry himself opened the door for it, we've had this discussion about how this had been discussed in diplomatic circles behind the scenes for quite some considerable time. So Putin knows that there was already an idea out there, so it's even easier for him to step forward and to put something out where other people had already been suggesting it and talking about it, but it didn't look particularly feasible. So exactly as you said, Putin knows that he only has a limited set of cards to play, but he chooses his timing very carefully, and he waits for that exact moment where he can press the advantage. Now, the other thing, however, to make here point out here is that he makes mistakes too, and there are several issues in that op-ed where I think there might be an opportunity for us to move back in a different direction and try to regain the advantage. One of them is his continued insistence that it was likely the rebels that used the poison gas, as he puts it, in Syria. And that's something, of course, that will be fully in the spotlight when the United Nations Commission and inspectors have finished their report. So we'll see whether Vladimir Putin has to try to step around that issue.
Well, he added to that something that seems very, very off the wall after he'd mentioned that the opposition forces used chemical weapons to provoke intervention by their powerful foreign patrons, which I imagine is the US and Saudi Arabia,
right,
who would be siding with the fundamentalists. Reports that militants are preparing another attack, this time against Israel, cannot be ignored. Where's the evidence for that?
Well, it's a good question. But this is, again, classic Putin. He picks up on something that may have been out there in various reports or newspaper reports, I mean, maybe perhaps in the Russian press. And then he tries to spin this again to his advantage. It could be a complete red herring. But the interesting thing here on the use of just the idea of an attack against Israel is that when you look at Russia's position in the Middle East, it's a little precarious. It's not just that they have these alliances with Assad and Syria and the relationship with Iran, but Russia actually has a very good relationship with Israel right now. I want to just stress this point, that we're not in a Cold War game here in the Middle East. Russia is not the same player as the Soviet Union was, when the Soviet Union was always siding with the Palestinians, the PLO, and many other actors that were seen as antithetical to U.S. interests. Russia's actually really changed its position on a number of alliances and relationships, and Israel is a case in point. Very different setup there. Many of the Russian Jews who moved, and Soviet Jews who were Russian-speaking, who moved to Israel over the last 10, 20 years, have created a constituency in favor of a closer relationship with Russia. And Putin has exploited that, and there's some genuine interest on his part and some genuine affinity with Israel and improving the relationship, as many Israeli political figures will tell you. So they're in a bit of a bind here, and Putin has to do some fancy footwork to be able to balance all of these competing interests in his own policy in the Middle East. So, he may catch himself out.
Again, I'm speaking with Fiona Hill, who's the director of the Center on the United States and Europe and senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution. She's a frequent commentator on Russian and Eurasian affairs, who has researched and published extensively on issues related to Russia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, regional conflicts, energy and strategic issues. She's also the co-author of the new book just out, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. Now, on the one hand, Fiona Hill, it would seem that it's not a good idea to humiliate Russia publicly and by taking out Assad or his regime. That's not what we're threatened to do, but I think it's also a subtext of what we might be preparing to do. And if he can't defend his own only ally and his only base in the Mediterranean, it's not helpful, I think, to humiliate him. But on the other hand, it's also worth reminding our audience that from day one, Putin has basically frustrated any efforts to bring Assad to account. And most of the analysts I talk to on Syria say that had the U.S. moved vigorously when the revolution first started, when Assad was on his back foot, and that was a time when Hillary Clinton was confidently saying he's going to fall, had we done something beyond rhetoric that proved to be inaccurate, we might have had a chance then. But now that the Saudis have allowed these jihadis in, who justify, in effect, Assad's rule, we are in a possible situation.
That's absolutely right. And Putin was obviously well aware of that right from the very beginning. But he does not want to see Assad fall. And the question, of course, is why? Is it just to protect his ally in the region, as you point out in the question? There's a bigger issue at stake here. Putin doesn't want to see regime change in any country, frankly, because he worries that this may eventually raise the specter of regime change in Russia itself. He's opposed U.S. military interventions across the board, and of course, he very grudgingly accepted the proposition of an intervention in Libya, because he was somewhat in the background then as prime minister when Dmitry Medvedev was president, and ever since then, he has criticized that decision of his former Russian president and his colleague Dmitry Medvedev for allowing that to happen. He's made it very clear that intervention to change regimes is antithetical to his views. And then there's his question that he lays out in the op-ed: what happens next in Syria? Who keeps the country in check? And he throws back at the United States in this op-ed, obviously, all of the interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere, and talking about the worsening of the situations there. Putin wants Assad to stay because he sees Assad as the last bastion against chaos in Syria, and that's in spite of all of his flaws. I don't think Putin has any illusions whatsoever about Assad's abilities or the way that he will conduct himself. But Putin looks at the alternatives to Assad and he doesn't see one. And he is perfectly happy to have Assad brutalize the Syrian population to keep the disintegration, the complete disintegration of the country in check. And we have to remember that Putin has done exactly the same in his own civil war in Chechnya. He came into office in 1999 against the renewal of war in Chechnya, and he presided over a very bloody struggle, pretty much similar in scale to what we're seeing in Syria now, although I have to say that Syria, the broader implications of this are much, much larger than what we saw in Chechnya. And he wants to give Assad a fighting chance to basically wrest some kind of control over the situation. So that's where we really differ from Russia over the issue of Syria. He wants to see stability in the longer term. He doesn't care particularly about democracy. I mean, I think he makes that relatively clear in the op-ed as well when you start parsing the language there. And he's got a very strong stomach for the kind of slaughter that we find completely reprehensible and basically unacceptable. Vladimir Putin has been there, done that, seen that, and that is not going to motivate him to change his position on Syria.
But in effect, it would seem, Fiona Hill, if we go ahead and this deal goes down, even though there's obviously a lot of problems getting rid of a chemical weapons arsenal, a fairly substantial one in the midst of a civil war, but assuming we go ahead with the Russian deal, we're selling out the majority of the Syrians who opposed the regime, and the regime, if it's able to consolidate, will slaughter the rest of its opponents. So we're definitely selling out the so-called Free Syrian Army. But in terms of touching the buttons with the American audience, which is clearly weary of war due to the Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice lies about WMDs that didn't exist, now, of course, make rogue states want to get WMDs. He makes reference, of course, to that notion that he's saying here, thus a growing number of countries seek to acquire weapons of mass destruction. This is logical. If you have the bomb, no one will touch you. We are left with talk of the need to strengthen nonproliferation when in reality this is being eroded. Now, if we could take him at his word here, and if the US and Russia can work effectively to disarm Syria at the same time, as I point out, selling out the revolution, maybe that same model could be applied to Iran. So there's something positive there, don't you think?
Well, there is. And I think that's the challenge for us now. Basically, Putin has moved the game in a certain direction, and he's taken advantage of our missteps. And right now, it's Mr. Putin who has scored on this one. The challenge for us now is to put the ball back in our court and for us to be able to turn the situation to our advantage and start to move in the direction that we want to see this. We have to make sure that we don't completely sell out the Syrian Free Army and all of the other positive forces in Syria that are really trying to push for a genuine change in the way that Syria is managed and is governed. I think our big problem now is that we're much more looking like the kind of scenario that we saw in the Balkans and, you know, the 90s onwards. But, you know, when you start to think about the slaughter in the Balkans and where we ended up with Dayton, with someone as accomplished as Richard Holbrook really trying to script out what happened next, it wasn't that terrible an outcome. It wasn't the outcome that we would have liked to have seen with all of the piecemeal carving up of what was Yugoslavia. And unfortunately, that's maybe what we're going to be looking at in the case of Syria, another reconfiguration of that state. But if we can do this in a way where we're writing the script, if we're moving forward and we try to salvage something out of this, it's not necessarily a terrible outcome here. So that's where you're right, where there may be something that we can make out of this. And also with an eye to these other cases where we have to deal with this issue of non-proliferation, of disarmament, and really curbing the use of chemical weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. If we play our own cards right now and remembering that we do have certain strengths, we can turn this to our advantage. I guess the question has to be, are we able to do that? We've got to think very carefully now, I think, about who we put in charge of this, who we send out to deal with Putin, how we handle ourselves, and we have to really be very clear about what it is that we're trying to do here.
Well, just in closing, Fiona Hill, the Dayton Accords, of course, happened because the U.S. used force. But just to finish up with what Putin finished up with in his op-ed, where he said he took on the case of American exceptionalism, stating that the United States policy is what makes America different. It what makes us exceptional, quoting Obama there. It is extremely dangerous to encourage people to see themselves as exceptional. Whatever the motivation, there are big countries and small countries, rich and poor, those with long democratic traditions and those still finding their way to democracy. Their policies differ too. We are all different. But when we ask for the Lord's blessing, we must not forget that God created us equal. Now, it's true that all of our presidents rather jingoistically always end their addresses by saying God bless America or God bless the United States, and it seems to be a political ritual here. You think that Putin has thrown this back at Obama effectively?
Not effectively, but he's certainly thrown it back, and that was actually the paragraph that you know, I found myself the most offensive when I really thought about what the Russians were trying to do with this in terms of their public diplomacy and trying to find things that would resonate with an American audience. I think this is where they lost it in the last paragraph. I mean, there's obviously some pretty rank hypocrisy in there, but, you know, everybody tends to be hypocritical about these kinds of things in public affairs and global diplomacy. President Putin's entire base since he came into office in 1999 has been predicated on Russian exceptionalism. I mean, he came out in his very first address talking about Russia being a standalone civilization that had to go back to its own values and reject copying Western models. So he probably, or whoever wrote this for him, that they could have added an additional line about God created as equal, but some more equal than others, in the words of Animal Farm. Because certainly Putin has said over and over again on so many occasions that there are only a few truly sovereign nations in the world, and Russia is one of those very, very few that really stand for something unique in terms of their national sovereignty, their statehood, etc. So, you know, this here was really where it was the kind of the most blatant attempt at manipulating and pushing back again the words of President Obama and the United States are back in a different footing. And President Putin is going to be presiding over the next week, and at least people in the Kremlin are, over a meeting of international experts of Valdai Discussion Club, where they're going to talk about Russian identity and essentially Russian exceptionalism. So, I mean, this really underscores, in many respects, what Putin was trying to do here, which is really change the discussion, push and refute, push back and refute the words of President Obama, and really, you know, essentially just underscore again how he is playing with words and with issues to try to do this to his own effect. So, well, I mean, for me, that paragraph was the one. If they'd left that out, I think, you know, a lot of the other arguments that they were making could have been quite compelling. It was really, in a way, that last paragraph that showed President Putin's hand.
Well, Fiona Hill, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
No, thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Fiona Hill, who's the director of the Center on the United States and Europe and senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. She's a frequent commentator on Russian and Eurasian affairs who has researched and published extensively on issues related to Russia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, regional conflicts, energy and strategic issues. She's also the co-author of the new book just out, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a chemical weapons specialist on how difficult it is to get rid of these weapons.